Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 5 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we addressed Andalusia's sacking season, we discussed Brian Gruda's timely emergence for a struggling Mineside, and we put Milan's post-derby resurgence under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We were also joined by friend of the podcast, Luke Entwistle, for a deep dive into all things on and off the field of play at AS Monaco. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe, hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, we're back once again for another episode of the Road to Nowhere podcast. Rudy Barlow and Michael Jones are primed and ready to go for another hour or so, unpacking all the latest goings on around Europe's major leagues. I'll come to you first, Rudy Barlow. How is Madrid treating you these days, and how was your holiday in the south of Spain?
Oh, it was glorious, Ali. It was very, very nice, it has to be said. I was down in Cadiz, I was in Seville. Obviously, there was a sour moment during my Seville trip, but had some very good food, spent a lot of time at the beach. And Alan Feely, who we were just discussing a moment ago, gave me some very good recommendations for probably some of the best Lebanese food I've ever had. So, delicious.
Good stuff. There's a very nice Lebanese restaurant in Strasbourg. If anyone's ever in Strasbourg, drop me a message and I'll give you the name of that restaurant. Its name escapes me right now, but yeah, some tremendous food on offer there. Glad to hear you had a lovely time in the south, Barlow. I'll come to you now, Michael Jones. You're kitted and ready for your game of five asides this evening. Are you looking forward to that game, or are you looking forward more to chatting with me and Barlow for an hour?
Yeah, I'm just very happy to be indulging fully in a football themed evening. So I was a bit disappointed that it's already taken a turn in terms of talking about Lebanese food, which in all seriousness is a joke. I really like Lebanese food, but I don't have any continental recommendations, only a couple of good places in Sheffield. So yeah, if anyone's in Sheffield, sunny Sheffield, give us a bow. What about you, Ali?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Very well, thanks. Spent quite a few weekends when I was growing up in Sheffield. My cousins were originally from Sheffield, so I know the area well as well. So maybe we can put our heads together and come up with a programme of events for a Sheffield City break, perhaps. Maybe the Sheffield Tourism Board can get us involved. But anyway, enough on the joys of Sheffield. And I think we should probably now turn our attention to Italian football. Serie A has new leaders in the form of AC Milan, who secured their fourth consecutive victory in rather extraordinary fashion. It was Christian Pulisic's late goal that clinched a 1-0 win against the league's basement dwellers, Cagliari. However, most will remember this game for Olivier Giroud's unexpected heroics in goal. Could you walk us through those remarkable moments, Michael, and tell us how Stefano Pioli has responded to such a dramatic turn of events in the aftermath of the recent derby disappointment?
Yeah, it's been a massive turnaround. I don't think anybody, well, to the day, this time last month, we're recording on the 17th of October, the 17th of September, AC Milan were, one day into the hangover of that 5-1 derby demolition at the hands of Inter Milan. Since then, it's been a dramatic turnaround. They've gone undefeated, They've drawn both Champions League games, but they've won all four domestic games, including a 2-0 victory at home to Lazio. And they've only conceded one goal in those six games, which have included those Champions League games against both Newcastle United, who we saw what they were capable of against Paris Saint-Germain, and Borussia Dortmund at Dortmund as well, which is a fortress of a place to go in Europe as well. But the game that's grabbed the most attention, which I don't think people would have also expected within the next month, was that 1-0 victory away to Genoa on the Saturday before the international break. Now, it was quite a cagey game. Genoa have made quite a bright impression since coming up from Serie B after spending one season down there. But yeah, in the 87th minute, Christian Pulisic, he scored his fourth goal of the season to make him joint top scorer for the Rossoneri. Lovely goal on the turn, which beats Jose Martinez, a Genoa keeper. Genoa looking for a handball, not given. And that was the start of what was a good contentious 20 minutes or so from the 87th minute, it must be said. And yeah, 7 minutes of injury time are then given. And in the seventh minute of injury time, Mike Maignan is dismissed. At first, it looks like he's actually injured himself coming out for the ball, but he's actually dismissed for taking out Genoa attackers. They launched the ball forwards and he's come flying into it, similar to that famous, I can't remember the name of the goalkeeper now, but the famous incident in the World Cup match, I think it was at the 1986 or 82 World Cup between France and West Germany at the time. But yeah, reminiscent of that, he gets sent off. And then Olivier Giroud has to go in goal. And from the resulting free kick, Genoa deflected effort hits the bar. Giroud, who, you know, actually between the sticks, actually that's quite a natural goalkeeper, maybe more than he does a striker view, just to see the sort of silhouette of him on a football pitch. But then, yeah, he makes this really crucial interception in the dying minutes of stoppage time, which keeps that clean sheet, that those four clean sheets in Serie A in a row for AC Milan, which ultimately takes them top of the table as well. And then, you know, just to add a bit more to the game, Jose Martinez, the Genoa goalkeeper who was beaten, he gets the second yellow card in the opposition box for a lunging sliding tackle, which probably could have been a straight red as well. So an absolutely fantastic game where goalkeepers were playing up front and goalkeepers and strikers were playing in goal. But yeah, I guess to that other question that you asked, Ali, in terms of, you know, how he's responded to such a dramatic turn of events, I think Pioli was under quite a bit of pressure after that 5-1 defeat to Inter Milan. There was question marks over AC Milan's recruitment during the summer, whether they were sort of attracting the type of profile that's going to sort of take them further than what they were, which was sort of, you know, they had won the league, the Scudetto in 2021. They'd fallen away last season, were quite far off the pace, and I think there were concerns that that would be the case again with this kind of form that Inter Milan had displayed in that derby game, and they have showed in some games since then. But Inter Milan's inconsistency, which ultimately cost them in 2021, seems to, or 2022 even, sorry, seems to have, like, that could be coming back to bite them again. And Stefano Pioli and what he's done really well, what was really important to that title victory a year and a half ago now, has really come to the fore. But I think one of the most impressive things with this sort of run of consistency is just how impressively Pioli's been able to embed these new signings and a raft of them as well. You know, like I said, Pulisic, he's joint top scorer of Olivier Giroud, new signing who I think had a really underwhelming end to his Chelsea career. And I think there was probably question marks over his longevity at a club, given the sort of impact he'd had at Borussia Dortmund, maybe just before he joined Chelsea. As well, Yunus Musa has, although not a regular starter, has been a breath of fresh air for them. And yeah, they've kind of, Ruben Loftus-Cheek scored an absolute screamer in their victory over Cagliari. And there's countless examples. Reinders, a player, Reinders, a player who we talked about on the podcast a few weeks ago, who's made a really big impression since arriving from AZ Alkmaar. He now looks like a big player for the Dutch national team, having played in their last two games over the international break as well. And they've, you know, most of them have actually gotten the score sheet at least once Noah Okafor from Red Bull Salzburg has scored twice recently. And there seems to be that sort of, you know, players really want to play in this Pioli system, which is both now really fluid in its midfield and the attack. Rafa Leão, who was given the September Player of the Month award in Serie A, has, despite only scoring 3 league goals, he's been really creative with his output and using his dribbling to create so much space for others. And the type of midfielders and attackers that Milan are signing are just perfect for Pioli's football at the moment, where he loves having players sort of running onto passes sort of cut back either across the box or on the edge of the box in shooting positions. And they've got so many of their goals that way. And I think it bodes really well for them. They've got a really defining week coming up for them in terms of sort of this stage of the season, and especially given it's their sort of biggest tests since that big defeat away to Inter Milan. So they've got Juventus at home on Sunday, then they've got Paris Saint-Germain on Wednesday, and then they've got Napoli away from home the next Sunday. So some really big games coming up. But given AC Milan's recent form, if people have maybe paid more attention to their sort of quiet start to the Champions League and that derby despair against Inter Milan, there's certainly a bit more balance to this case, and there's a reason that Pioli's successfully got them to the top of the league so far.
Yes, interesting stuff there. And Serie A is shaping up to be pretty fascinating this season. It's been a good start. Moving on to a Milan legend, Filippo Inzaghi made his return to the top tier of Italian football by taking the helm at the second from bottom club, Salernitana, after they parted ways with Paolo Sosa. Winless in their first 8 games this season, what has gone wrong for a coach who was once held in pretty high regard? And what's the rationale behind bringing in Super Pippo, who, at first glance, let's be honest, has had limited success at the highest level?
Yeah, I think Pippo Inzaghi, it was interesting. We made the argument last episode or the episode before when we were discussing Fabio Grosso. And I know in England, there's that conversation over whether ex-footballers like Sir Gerard Lampard and now Rooney, you know, taking the Birmingham job and maybe sort of walking into jobs unfairly. And I think that's probably there's a bigger case for that in Italy. You know, when you look at Gennaro Gattuso taking the Marseille job now, you know, if anything, these guys are actually sort of, their legacies are carrying them over into getting pretty high profile European jobs, obviously Valencia, Grosso now at Lyon. But yeah, Pippo Inzaghi, who has had really limited success, his last proper spell in Serie A was in the 2020 to 2021 season, which was, I think, our second series of the podcast, when he took over Benevento, and he did get them promoted, but they also got relegated. They quite famously defeated Juventus 1-0 in that time in March, but then they went on to not win the remaining 10 games of Serie A, which ultimately cost them. They're probably on course to stay up, actually, at that point. They only went down by 4 points. But yeah, it's been a really, really disappointing start. And I think it's quite amazing or incredible that Salernitana are only second bottom and not bottom. They, Empoli, who hadn't scored against them a few weeks ago, beat them 1-0, but could have beat them about 3 or 4-0. They got torn apart by Torino, who have really struggled in front of goal. Torino beat them 3-0. This season, they drew 1-1 with Frosinone, which was the last time they scored a goal. That was Yvan Cabral, a player we'll get onto in a moment. But they've, in terms of the squad quality to last season, I think they're in a much weaker position. They've not really brought many players in, and I still don't think they've ever really replaced the likes of Edison from when they had their miraculous escape 2 seasons ago also. And I think it's a huge, huge challenge for Inzaghi, arguably bigger than the one Davide Nicola had when he saved them from relegation. And when Sosa came in and steadied the ship last season, one of the reasons that they've been really struggling is Sosa has tried to get them on the front foot at times and playing a particularly high line, which has just destroyed the confidence within the squad. And there was a really clear case when they lost to Monza in the last game when Andrea Corpani, I think we're going to hear a little bit more about on the podcast today, was just able to sort of glide through without really any challenges. And that's been a theme of their defending. They've been backing off constantly. Guillermo Ochoa, a goalkeeper who's, you know, synonymous with World Cup heroics, is maybe showing the reasons why he never really established himself at the top level. As for every amazing save he seems to make an utterly bizarre goalkeeping decision, whether it's using his feet when you should definitely be using your hands, or positioning, which has also been really costly for them. Ultimately, their biggest problem, though, has been in front of goal. Goals have been really few and far between at the moment. Will Idea, who was on the verge, well, Wolverhampton Wanderers, we went in for him on deadline day in what Salernitana's director described as a diplomatic incident in the way that we went for him. And that, I can't remember what the other quote was off the top of my head, but it was something along the lines of Wolves needing to have a very hard look at themselves. But, you know, Dia then went on strike over the incident. And I think maybe one of the rationale for bringing in Zaghi is that, you know, it might just inspire Dia to maybe, although he has just made a return to the first team, which is much needed as he's him alongside Antonio Candreva is probably the star players, that he's going to be really needed for any kind of success they have this season. I think the one saving grace for Salernitana is that there's some pretty bad teams around them. The next two games are Cagliari and Genoa, two really big games for them. Then they have a run of games until Christmas when they don't play a team below 12th in Serie A. So they really need to maximise their points over the next two games. But if they don't, they could be cast away by Christmas. And yeah, really worrying times and a huge job for Pippo Inzaghi. Worst case scenario, I'd like to see Salernitana maybe stick with him, given he's got a track record of getting teams promoted from Serie B. He left Reggiana at the end of last season after getting them to the playoffs against the odds, but he only departed because of financial reasons. So yeah, really intriguing one. It'll add a bit more notoriety to the club this season as well. But yeah, I'm excited to see how Inzaghi does in the south of Italy.
One club that seems to have no intention of parting ways with their manager is Monza, who secured their second consecutive victory just before the international break, propelling them into the European places. We've often discussed their coach Raffaele Ballerino on this podcast, but this time, let's shift our focus to an exciting talent they have in their ranks. Michael, could you tell us more about Andrea Colpani and what sets him apart as a unique footballer?
Yeah, briefly discussed his goal against Salernitana, but I thought it'd be very fitting to kind of describe a bit of a throwback player in the wake of the David Beckham documentary that's been released, I believe, since the last time we recorded. And Colpani is just that. I mean, this is a guy who's come through the youth ranks in Italy, came through the famed Primavera of Atalanta. And despite never making a first team appearance for them, he was instrumental in helping Monza get promoted. He then was a key player in Italy's under 20 World Cup semi-final run a couple of years ago in a team that also featured, I think in 2019 even, sorry, that featured Andrea Pinamonti, Gianluca Scamacca, and he was a driving force in midfield for them. And yeah, he had a good debut season with Monza in Serie A last season, albeit wasn't one of the sort of standout talents, you might say. He scored 4 goals across the whole of the campaign. This time around, he's matched that and he's got 4 goals already. You know, his first 2 goals were emphatic as they saw Monza defeat Empoli by those 2 goals. His recent goal versus Salernitana was impressive, but yeah, also he's just been a really fantastic player to watch. He's got long sort of brown locks. I think watching him is kind of reminiscent of seeing highlights of David Ginola. And yeah, he is not the fastest, doesn't seem to be sort of the biggest of a pressing player, very much a bit of a luxury player, but with a good work rate. And I think, you know, the assumptions of that's what Beckham was like. I think you'd maybe watch a lot of clips of him and you realise a lot more to Beckham's game. And I think there are similarities between the two players as well. So, yeah, I think he's a player who seems to thrive, scores the spectacular goals, a left-footed player, either plays on the right of a central midfield three or on the right side of midfield, loves to cut in on his left foot. doesn't have any assists so far this season, but he's second for expected assists in Serie A this season as well. So I would expect him to start notching more numbers to his name, despite already having an impressive start. But yeah, he's playing alongside Papu Gomez, who only joined at the end of September now. Matteo Pessina, Roberto Gagliardini, Lorenzo Colombo, who's on loan from AC Milan up front. A really exciting team that they've got there at Monza this season. More exciting than last season's, which, you know, takes some doing. So, yeah, a team to really get behind this season for sort of, I guess, purely football reasons and for looking at the players that they have amongst them. But quite an exciting project from the neutral.
Yeah, always interesting to see how Monza are faring, Michael. So thank you very much for that update and for the update on the whole on all things Serie A. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Now we're going to dial in Luke Entwistle from the south coast of France. And yeah, we're going to unpack all things AS Monaco. We'll be right back. AD Hooters Monaco top the league and table after 8 match days, picking up 17 points and scoring a league-high 21 goals in the process. To appraise their promising early season form on the pitch and unpack certain developments off the field of play, we're delighted to be joined by friend of the podcast and Get French football news editor Luke Entwistle, who's dialing in from Nice, just along the coast from the Stade Louis II. Luke, how's the French life treating you?
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Alistair. Not too bad. 26 degrees in mid-October in the south of France, so you can't really complain, can you? So yeah, happy to be on and to be speaking about one of these Côte d'Azur clubs that is having a great start to the season. I'm pretty well placed to watch all of the, you know, the top of the table Ligue 1 action this season, which was not the case last season. So very happy about that.
Yeah, look, it goes without saying really that you're extremely well positioned to comment on all things Monaco. So yeah, just I suppose looking firstly at the men in the dugout, where did it go wrong latterly for Philippe Clément, who's of course just been announced as the new manager of Rangers in Scotland? Where did it go wrong for Clément prior to his dismissal in July this year? And what has his successor, Eddy Houtter, done differently to enable the club's early season form?
I mean, yeah, it's quite interesting we're speaking about Philippe Clément now because, as you say, he has just been appointed as Rangers manager. And so I'm kind of looking back at his time at Monaco and trying to see exactly what did go wrong. I think when we were in the midst of it last, you know, towards the end of last season, it was quite hard to see exactly what went wrong. And I think even now it's difficult to pinpoint, you know, there was this tactical shift or specifically kind of honing on one aspect of, you know, that there was a drop off there. I think that there was overall, and I think actually from the World Cup, to be honest, a drop off that then started to become more ingrained and more evident as the season progressed. So we spoke before the World Cup about how great their midfield was, you know, Youssef Fofana, Mohamed Camara, who did look like a bargain and is, you know, is a great player and will grow into a brilliant player. But both of those two players were absolutely fantastic before the World Cup. And the drop-off in particular from Fofana post-World Cup was, it was notable. It was very, very stark, the difference between the Fofana that we saw pre-World Cup and post-World Cup. And I think he became aware of that himself towards the end of the season. And I think that if you lose your midfield, I think that you lose control of the games. And the thing about Monaco is it's a possession-based side. And if you have particular Fofana, who is supposed to be the more progressive of the two, the one that does break the lines with a pass or a dribble, and against low blocks, which is what you generally come up against in Ligue 1, when you have drop-offs of players of that importance, I think that you're naturally going to see a drop-off in the collective performance, and that is what took hold. I think as well, it wasn't just Fofana and it wasn't just Camara. I think it was most of the players almost in that squad. And Philippe Clément, in many press conferences towards the very, very end, we're talking the final 3 to 4 games, who had been very, very defensive of his players, who, you know, their performances weren't there, but he would never throw them under the bus. And I don't think he ever did throw them under the bus anyway, but he did start to criticise them towards the end of the campaign. and basically alluding to the fact that lots of these players will be getting, or think they will be getting, big transfers. Of course, some of them did, Axel Di Sassi, some of them didn't. Youssef Fofana was expected to leave. The club fully expected him to leave. All internal sources said this is his summer to get his transfer, and ultimately that did not happen because there was interest but in club from clubs that he wasn't necessarily interested in going to, so you likes of Nottingham Forest and Fulham. So he's very happy to stay, actually, in the end. But yeah, there was just this drop off from too many key players, and you can't accuse them of purposefully lowering their level, but in the subconscious they think they're leaving, and there is just that tiny little drop off, and it's just a tiny little drop off at this level when your objectives are as high as AS Monaco's. It makes all the difference, and that's where you get that late season complete drop off, multiple losses when you were in the Champions League conversation, and on the final day of the season you find yourself not even in the Europa Conference League spot after a late defeat to Toulouse. So it went wrong very gradually last season, even though the actual results only kind of really dropped off right at the end of the season. I think there was a drop off in performance from these key players basically from January onwards.
Yeah, and I suppose, obviously, for Clément, it did go wrong, as you say, quite gradually. What have we seen from Huerta since he arrived in the Principality?
So Huerta, he was a bit of an unknown quantity coming in because there were a decent amount of managers linked with the job, but not a lot of people around here knew a lot about many of them. Jesse Marsh was the one that seemed like the most likely for a long time. But there was an acceptance or this kind of understanding that there would likely be a Red Bull coach coming through, or someone who has worked previously within the Red Bull system, because it's become almost a little bit of a joke, but AS Monaco has slightly become RB Monaco in recent times. Of course, Paul Mitchell, the now former sporting director, has experience within the Red Bull system, and his replacement, Thiago Scuro, is brought straight from Red Bull Bragantino in Brazil. So there is very much this desire for this well, what is actually its own multi-club model with Cercle Bruges in Belgium, to kind of have a slightly Red Bull outlook on how to manage that multi-club model. So that's why you've got the consistency of Scuro, and you've got the consistency, or the arrival, I should say, of Huerta, who does have experience within that system. I think that the changes haven't been wholesale. I think that he is, or can be, even though we've not seen it, slightly more tough on his players behind the scenes. You always heard about Clément, about how he is a brilliant, brilliant man manager. You know, really is very, very close to his players. With Huerta, what you see is, or what we've not seen, but what we're told is that, okay, you know, he can be very close to his players, but also he can have a slightly more ruthless streak as well. So that is something that maybe is behind the scenes, and that is also helping get the best out of some of these young players who are really performing. On a tactical level, I think that the move to two number 10s rather than one number 10 is probably the most stark difference, and the one that is making the biggest difference on the pitch, because we'll probably get into, you know, the players more specifically, but players such as Takumi Minamino and Alexander Golovin, players who, well, Golovin performed really well last season, coming in from a slightly wider position. But particularly Minamino looks very much lost within that system, actually quite rarely played in the number 10 role. But with another creative element next to him in this kind of dual 10 position, he is a player that looks reborn. And you've got players like Golovin who have continued their form. And then you have players like Magnus Akush who, with all the absences, managed to basically step up and get that win essentially almost single-handedly against Marseille. So I'd say that that's the biggest change in terms of shape. And I think that overall the mentality is just, it's a lot more gung-ho. There was a little bit more reticence to throw all of your attacking players in the team and to really go for it all the time under Clément, naturally. But essentially what we're seeing at Monaco this year is you know, Huerta just trying to outscore his opponents. I think he realizes, and well, he does because he speaks about it very often, he realizes his defense is not quite what he wants it to be yet. So his way of mitigating that is just to try and score as many goals as possible. And that's why Monaco are the top scorers in the league. That's why, you know, Balogun has hit, apart from those two penalty misses, hit the ground running, why Ben Yedder has continued to score. So that's the main kind of changes this mentality to really go for an attack, basically, and really get the most out of all of those very talented attacking players that are in the squad.
Yeah, really makes for a good watch for the neutral anyway. Look, you've alluded to them there, but I think our listeners would be quite keen to hear a little bit more about Takumi Minamino and Foran Balogun. So firstly, why does Minamino look for all the world like a player reborn this season after a difficult campaign last time out? And secondly, Balogun, how has, well, you've said he's hit the ground running. How has he managed to hit the ground running at the Stade Louis-II following his summer move from Arsenal?
So on Minamino, I think there's a couple of factors. We spoke with him at the start of the season, where it is quite clear that he was a very different player, and he didn't go into great detail, but he did allude to the fact that his adaptation last year, new country, new language that he, you know, he really doesn't speak, and just completely new surroundings. I think that it's an element that is often overlooked. It is a very, very important factor in the adaptation of a player on the pitch, is how they are getting on off the pitch. And it's clear straight away in training, just around the club in general, that he felt a lot more at ease in his surroundings a year on. He arrived with a small injury last season, which we weren't aware of at the time. And I think that kind of impacted his pre-season, impacted the start of his season at AS Monaco slightly. And I think it then became a little bit of a spiral at that point, that he started the season poorly. He's within unfamiliar surroundings, and it's quite hard then to pick yourself up. Then you get, you know, you're dropped from the Japanese squad, and you were once, you know, the player within that Japan squad, and then you get to the World Cup and you kind of demoted to the bench, and then he wasn't in the squad at all towards the end of the season as well. So I think mentally it was quite a difficult season for Takumi Minamino, but speaking to people around the club at the end of the last season, there was actually surprisingly a lot of enthusiasm and optimism about Minamino and the fact that he will probably bounce back next season. And at the time, I was wondering what that was kind of based on, you know, why is there such optimism and such belief that he will bounce back? Because he really hadn't shown it in his first season, but ultimately he does bounce back. As I say, I think tactically, beyond, you know, the mental aspects, you've got the tactical element of the dual number 10, which really, really suits him. I think he really enjoys playing off a striker like Ben Yedder as well. So you've kind of got that triangle of Ben Yedder or Balogun, Golovin and Minamino, that it just fits with the way that he wants to play and fits with the way that he has. When we've seen him at his best, he's been within these kind of systems where he's been close to the attacker and he's been close to other creative players. And then there's also the fact that he knows Adi Hütter. They work together, albeit very, very briefly, in Salzburg. And I think that can also help the fact that not only Hütter understands his game and his strengths, but also the fact that it makes Minamino potentially feel a little bit more comfortable. Someone he knows, someone from when he's actually quite a young player as well. I can only imagine that mentally that does you a lot of good. And then you got on to Balogun, who he's had a very, very quick adaptation. And I think one of the best things about this adaptation is that you do have a player like Ben Yedder who can and has been starting many games as well. So there's no burden of responsibility there for him, as there was in Reims. You know, at Reims, he was the main man and he did get the goals. I think that, you know, Balogun is seen as the successor to Ben Yedder, who is expected to leave at the end of the season, maybe even before. Let's see what happens in January. But his contract is up in the summer. There's no talk of renewal. He's comfortably, by a long, long way, the highest earner at the club, and it's the kind of wage that they do not want on their bill anymore. So he looks like he'll go, and then Balogun will become the main man then at Monaco. So it's a gradual process. That's why you'll see Ben Yedder sometimes starting, and then Balogun at other times as well. And I think that the early signs are that he will be a very able replacement for Ben Yedder. I alluded to those two penalty misses, but he bounced straight back and he got that crucial goal against Olympique de Marseille in particular. scored on his first away outing in Lorient as well. Overall, the signs are very, very positive at the start of the season for him.
Yeah, I'm glad that Balogun is faring well. Really enjoyed following his progress at Reims last season. And yeah, the move to Monaco, an interesting one for sure. Now, a couple of younger players, I suppose Balogun himself is fairly young, but anyway, a couple of even younger players have really started to catch the eye in the Principality. We've got 21-year-old attacking midfielder Magnus Agliucci, and we've got 20-year-old defensive midfielder Sungutu Magasa, who have both been given decent first-team minutes across the first 8 weeks or so of the new season. So, Luke, how would you describe their respective playing styles, and how good could the duo go on to become?
So Agliucci is an interesting one because he was a player who was spoken about a lot internally and also by the club's fans for many months, if not years. The kind of the big talent coming out of the La Diagonal Academy. And then it felt as though he almost lost his way a little bit because he just couldn't quite take that step from being involved in match day squads to becoming a starter. And then towards the end of last season, you had Elias Bensagir, who plays in the exact same position, who is a similar player in some ways, coming through and really making a name for himself and very quickly becoming undroppable. So I think there were doubts that Agliucci, who was the one who had all these hopes put on his shoulders, would ultimately never actually make it as a first-team player at Monaco. A few things have changed, change of manager. But also a few other things, notably the fact that Bensagir has been injured all season. Not great for him, and he's actually coming back, I believe, this weekend. But that has really given the opportunity for Agliucci to get more minutes. And I've already mentioned the dual number 10s. That also massively helps him because it gives him two positions in which he can play. He'd sometimes feature outside on the right when it was the 4-2-3-1 under Clément. It's just not a role that suited him. He just didn't look that comfortable there. He was kind of quite marginalised. He was out of the game. He was too quiet, and quite often he'd be the first one to be hooked in those kind of fixtures when he's featuring out on the right. But he is a player who has lots of room for progression, could be a lot more physical. Finishing has been an issue, wasn't an issue against Marseille with those two brilliant finishes. But who I saw him... It was one of the first training sessions I went to when I arrived in Monaco, and he was kind of on the near touchline. And unlike other Ligue 1 clubs where sometimes you're in the God zone, actually kind of 2 miles away from the pitch, it seems. At Monaco, it's great because you're allowed within about a couple of meters. Sometimes you get to pass the ball back to him as well. But he was right next to me. And you kind of, up close, it's the best first touch of any player I've ever seen up close. It was clearly technical ability. He had it in sways. So you kind of thought this should be a player who can break through. And now he seemingly is. You know, he's got those that room for progression, but he's a very, very technically gifted player. Just needs to round out his game a little bit, I think. And then Sungutu Magasa is a very different player. He is still a holding midfielder, although he has been featuring in defence. I spoke about the defence not being what Hutter wants it to be. That's for many reasons. Some of them to do with injuries and personnel and Salisu arriving and not actually being fit since he's arrived. That has meant that Magasa has had to fill in at left centre-back in kind of a very similar way that Badia Shield plays, actually. Very, very aggressive, pushing into the midfield. Sometimes gets caught out and leaves the rest of his defence a little bit stranded and struggling. But he is, unlike Badiashvili, he is definitely a midfielder. And that is what is being said. You know, he is doing very, very well to be 20 years old and to be filling in at centre-back, you know, which is a very high-pressure position. But to be filling in there when it is not your natural position is very impressive. And he's a very, very confident player on the ball. He's a good passer. But it's his intelligence that really stands out. It's his positioning. But yeah, he just sometimes maybe needs to contain that kind of aggression to press high, which is what is clearly his instinct is, which is not a bad instinct, especially if you're a defensive midfielder. But I think as a defender, it does leave him to be slightly caught out sometimes. But he's very much a player of the maybe more of the Aurelien Tchouameni ilk, maybe doesn't have the same level of ball progression Maybe that's something that will come in time. But yeah, he's very much a traditional number six, good positioning, very physical. I think that he can very much impose himself for a couple of years here at Monaco. And then if he does that, I think that he'll have a very bright future ahead of him.
All very promising indeed. Look, now taking the customary road to nowhere step back and looking at matters away from the field of play, the club confirmed the departure of sporting director Paul Mitchell at the start of October, and his successor Thiago Scuro has been given the title of general manager following a reshuffle of sorts. So looking ahead, Luke, what do Mitchell's departure and Scuro's appointment mean for Monaco's direction of travel?
So I've already kind of alluded to Scuro and the fact that it's very much a continuation of what we've seen before because of his path, basically. Mitchell announced that he wouldn't be extending his deal last April. The expectation was then he'd find a successor, he'd help his successor bed in, and once the successor was bedded in, he would leave. It's exactly what happened. He left a couple of weeks ago, returning to the UK, and now it's all up to Scuro, who... Yeah, like Mitchell, has the experience in the Red Bull system. So really, you're not going to see a big deviation from what we've seen in recent seasons. Although there is this idea that Mitchell had a very, very hard job when he was brought in. The club was in a very sticky situation financially. I alluded to Ben Yedder's contract, but most of the players at AS Monaco, or a lot of them, were on similar deals when he arrived. And he was given basically the task of reducing that wage bill massively, restoring some kind of equilibrium, and then allowing the club to go forward, which is now starting to do again. So I think that you'll see, or you know, they'd hope to see a club a genuine kind of upward trajectory and getting back to the Champions League places where that's where they believe they belong. This year, they stated that their objective is European football, keeping it nice and vague. But I think that they're very capable of making it to the Champions League this year. And then in terms of the reshuffle, let's see what that brings. But it seems like a positive step because it allows Scuro to have more of a stranglehold on all the operations of the club. The predecessors there, so the general managers or the CEOs have been Emmanuel De Witt, who didn't last very long at all, who didn't seemingly have much footballing knowledge, and then Ben Lambrecht, who was a lot more involved in the footballing side. But I think that this move will create a lot less conflict between the commercial aspects and the marketing aspects and the sporting aspects, which of course needs to be prioritized, and which of course Scuro will prioritize himself as well. So I think that will lead to less conflict potentially behind the scenes, things running maybe a bit smoother, you'd hope. And it's a big sign of confidence from the president, Dmitry Rybolovlev, who has basically given Scuro, who's only been in the building a couple of months, 3 months, 4 months even, a lot of power. You know, he's essentially given him carte blanche here. So let's see how he deals with all that responsibility and all that power. But obviously, Monaco currently top of the table. The early signs are, yeah, extremely positive.
Good stuff. Look, well, thank you very much for that. A very insightful look at all things AS Monaco. I'm sure our listeners will have picked up plenty from that. I certainly picked up plenty from that as well. We are going to draw to a close our analysis of Monaco there. We're going to turn our attention to Spain now, where we've got not one but two sackings to discuss. We'll be right back. It's that time of the podcast again. Sevilla have sacked another manager, this time the one that guided them to Europa League glory in José Luis Mendilibar. The Basque veteran reinvigorated Sevilla last season when it looked like they would be involved in the relegation scrap right until the end of the campaign, and returned their brio just in time for that European run. After just two wins from their opening 10 matches to start the season, however, Mendilibar is out the door and there's been a surprise appointment in Andalusia. Tell us more, Barlow.
Yeah, I'll try and explain the situation which is now facing Diego Alonso, who's the former Uruguay manager. And I'll try and do that just through what's happened to José Luis Mendilibar. I mean, the results have not been good. You mentioned those two wins. Those two wins are consisted of victories against Almeria and Las Palmas, so sides that are battling relegation, sides that are in and around that bottom half of the table. It's a side that have had good spells in games. They've scored goals at times. Enesiri's been in really good form. He's got the best out of Enesiri that I've seen any manager get out of him, it has to be said. But in terms of putting 19 minutes together, in terms of complete performances or just consistency, they struggle with 90 minutes Sevilla still. And some of the flaws that were there last season have ultimately kind of come back to bite them this season too. And there's plenty of games where they've looked like they were good for 3 points, or they've had the game kind of round the scruff of the neck against the likes of Alaves, Girona, Valencia, but it slipped through, or the other team has kind of managed to wrestle control back away from them. And Mendilibar is always a manager who's obviously taken charge of kind of, generally with the exception of Athletic Club, teams with lower resources, teams that are going to be battling relegation anyway. And I think that boldness, that kind of willingness to take risks is something that's worked well for him in his career, but something that perhaps this Sevilla side, which let's not forget was built by Julen Lopetegui, who is more risk averse and is kind of used to his ways, still kind of struggled to do too much with. So yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle this season. And to be honest, I think everyone who covers Spanish football closely kind of saw this coming for quite a while. I mean, Mendilibar was given a new 1-year contract. That was a sign and an indication of the fact that Sevilla didn't really believe in him, to be perfectly honest. They intended to appoint him until the end of the season, save them from relegation, and then look for the new manager. But Mendilibar obviously went and won the Europa League against all odds, and that kind of put them in a hole because the popular demand was for him to continue. And so that's why he ended up in the job. But new sporting director Monchi kind of left shortly after Mendilibar. The kind of decision was being taken. And then Victor Horta comes in, and Victor Horta obviously wants his own man in. And that man is Diego Alonso, who had a long playing career in Spain amongst various other places. He's only ever lasted longer than a year in the job. In management, in terms of his spells at Bellavista, Guarani, Peñarol, Olimpia, Pachuca, Monterrey, Inter Miami, and Uruguay, as we said. And yeah, he was at Pachuca for 4 years where he did good things. He won the CONCACAF Champions League. He won two of them. He won the Clausura. One of those CONCACAF Champions Leagues was with Monterrey. But he's facing kind of a similar challenge to Mendilibar in the sense that this is a squad that's cobbled together. There is obviously talent in it, but you're looking at Victor Horta, who's kind of come into this and just kind of tried to hold the decks down, tried to shift out some of the deadwood from the squad that wasn't wanted. Sergio Ramos has obviously come in after deadline day. That shows you the kind of desperation that Sevilla were in and the leadership that they needed to come on. He played pretty direct football with Uruguay during the World Cup. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but you look at the likes of Edinson Cavani and Luis Suarez, who were not used effectively during that Uruguay World Cup. And could it be a struggle for him kind of dealing with the veterans in the Sevilla side, which ultimately it needs a change of generation? I mean, the likes of Luke Bacchio, who's come in, hit the ground running in the Serie A, as I was saying, Ocampos, those are the type of players that this Sevilla side should be based on. But ultimately, they've never really shown the defensive solidity to back up the kind of firepower or lack of since Lopetegui left to kind of get these results out. And the one question I'd ask is that defence strong enough again to play kind of a more progressive football, which is something that Alonso has said that he's interested in, that he wants to bring to Sevilla. Loic Badé and Ramos are the two kind of stone walls that I think Sevilla can build this on. But he's got a lot of work to do, Alonso, and it's not an easy job at all. And this is not an appointment that is a sure thing. I mean, Horta will obviously have his candidates, but the job was offered to Marcelino beforehand. And we'll see if Alonso does get the backing. But I think it'll be a while before Sevilla, we can say, are consistently on the right track again.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how the Victor Horta project at Sevilla unfolds. But now on to another sacking in Andalusia that perhaps hasn't hit the headlines in quite the same way, but still concerns one of the more interesting jobs in Spain. Almeria, a rock bottom of La Liga, Vicente Moreno, the former Espanyol manager, has gone after 9 games, 3 draws, 6 defeats and 24 goals conceded. Ruby, the previous manager, resigned at the end of last season, but Almeria spent over 50 million euros this summer and were the league's second highest net spenders after Real Madrid. So why have things gone so poorly, and who is Vicente Moreno's replacement?
Yeah, they're an interesting case, Almeria. They're one of the kind of more interesting sides, despite the fact that they don't necessarily have the fan base or the kind of brand name that brings people's attention to them. They spent a number of years in Segunda, but they do have investment from Turki Alşık, who's linked to Saudi Arabia. They've a number of years in Segunda where they were kind of rifling through managers, some good, some bad. Guti was in charge for a spell. That was entertaining. Michel Sanchez, who's doing so well at Girona, was in charge for a stage. And Rubi, I think, was one of the better ones. He got promoted and kept them up last year. But the fact that he resigned tells you that probably not all is well, and it's still quite a difficult job at Almeria. Their strategy has been to kind of invest in young emerging talent that without the finance that they have, other teams in La Liga perhaps don't have access to. So we're talking the likes of Darwin Núñez, Umar Sadiq, who've obviously gone on to bigger money moves since a lot of the players that kind of come through this Almeria system or Almeria kind of transfer policy are those kind of wonder kids that you hear about from maybe lesser lights, not the wonder kids that Real Madrid and Barcelona are going for, but the ones that kind of have breakout seasons and then perhaps don't necessarily hold that kind of that kudos or that reputation to then get a really big move. And so, yeah, they've got the likes of Kaiki, who's a Brazilian central defender in at the minute. Vinicius Lázaro is a talented but very inconsistent Brazilian talent as well up front or out wide. Dion Lopi was brought in from Liga this summer, and Sergio Arribas, who was kind of the pearl of Real Madrid Castilla last season, and he's looked good as well. He scored quite a few goals, but I think there's a danger in that instability because, for instance, if you lose the likes of Rodrigo Elie and Sergian Babic, who are, again, not named brand defenders, they've replaced them with Edgar Gonzalez from Betis and Cesar Montes from Mexico and Espanyol. And those are, in theory, better players than the likes of Elie and Babic. But they're coming into a new system. They're coming into a new manager. They're coming into a side that's being rebuilt again. And this model of kind of selling on players, and it means that you're deprived of those regulars, you're deprived of those stalwarts and that kind of leadership structure. So the fact that they're attracting these players is very good for them, obviously, because they have that extra talent. They can spend a little bit of extra money, but perhaps when things are going poorly, when they're struggling, it can be a little bit dangerous because a lot of these players that are coming into Almeria are not there for the long haul. They are there to get their bigger move onwards in Europe. And I think they'll ultimately be okay. Gaizka Garitano is the man in charge now. He's a solid manager. He got Eibar promoted originally, came very close to getting them back into the division again. But this is a totally different challenge for him, and uniting the squad, getting them all pulling in the same direction. It's going to be interesting to see how he does. I think they are one of the certainly more curious sides in La Liga. They do have a bit of a striker issue for me. I think Luis Suarez is a good striker leading the line, but he's gone out for a couple of months. Ibrahim Kone is their latest on this line of strikers after Darwin Núñez, Umar Sadiq, and most recently Bilal Toure, who's come in and is set to lead the line. But I'm not sure I've seen enough quality from Kone yet to say that he is a good replacement. I think since Núñez went, it's been a gradual decline in terms of those strikers. So where Garitano finds those goals will be interesting to see. But in general, Almeria are just an interesting case to watch because there's so much kind of raw talent, but you're never quite sure what's going to come out.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm excited to see El Bilal Torre and see how he gets on in Italy. But yeah, back in Spain, finally, you were at the Spain-Scotland match in Seville last week, where the referee was the centre of attention, it's fair to say. Beyond that, what did we see from both sides, with both having now qualified for the European Championships? And congratulations to you both.
Yeah, delighted to see them qualify. I think I blacked out for about 10 minutes of that game after the goal was disallowed, where I was just trying to work out furiously on my phone, watching replays, texting people as to why that had been disallowed. It certainly attracted my ire, but yeah, it's one of those goals that I think they put it best on Sadio, that it's spiritually so onside. I mean, letter of the law, perhaps you could have made a case, there probably is a case that Hendry was interfering, or that he was offside, or whatever. But in terms of looking at it as a pure goal, I should have counted. Anyhow, moving on to that, I think Spain are a good side. They're a better side than we saw in March. They're more confident, they're more sure of themselves. I think Morata is in a brilliant moment of form as well. But I still think they're missing that little something against those low blocks. And Scotland, I don't think we're at their best in this match either. But they did cause Spain a few problems without necessarily having their best game, as I say. And you look at those kind of low blocks, you look at the likes of Balde and Carvajal, who Balde's been struggling a little bit this season, but Carvajal's been in brilliant form for Real Madrid. The fact that they weren't necessarily getting beyond their man, that they were kind of playing as kind of safety catches against those deeper blocks, which is what Spain tend to face in these big tournaments, that could potentially be an issue. And they'll need Morata to be in the same form, and he's been in fantastic form this season, if they are to stand a chance of getting kind of to the latter stages and ultimately winning the Euros without Lamine Yamal or Ansu Fati, if he can find his form again. I struggle to see if they have that spark, that one bit of quality in the final third that can open things up or give that passing option to the likes of Gavi or Pedri if he comes back. Defensively, I think they're always going to be a little bit vulnerable. Robin Lenormand and Aymeric Laporte appear to be the chosen ones in central defence. It's not a partnership that necessarily convinces me too much, but neither are they in great form. And I think what we're seeing from Spain here is a much more balanced side than we saw under Luis Enrique. And we'll find out during the Euros whether that's kind of good for them, whether they needed to kind of fully commit to this idea, or whether they needed to kind of take a step off and be a bit more pragmatic. So it'll be interesting to see that. And Scotland, I think Steve Clarke's done a brilliant job. Obviously, he's just a touch off that balance in those big games. I would like to see Billy Gilmore in here, because I think Spain struggled to hold the ball. You wonder, in that second half as well, do you go two strikers and have Dykes and Che Adams up front and maybe challenge Spain a bit more? Because as I said, they didn't look necessarily comfortable against Dykes and Christie kind of on their own. But obviously you're kind of sacrificing a little bit of stability in midfield there. So yeah, I think Clark is he's doing well. He is just a touch off that balance against the big teams. And it's not against the big teams that Scotland need to measure themselves necessarily. But if they do want to cause an upset, then perhaps that's one thing for Clark to look at.
Cracking insight, as always, Barlow. Yeah, as it turned out, obviously that result was inconsequential, because Spain did the business in Oslo on Sunday evening, and Scotland, yeah, on their way to a second consecutive European Championship. So yeah, I think it's fair to say that Mr. Clark has done a very commendable job. Okay, we will wrap up our analysis of Spanish football there. We're going to take another short break before coming back for part four. We're going to look at German football, and specifically Mainz. We'll be right back.
In Germany, it feels like no time has passed at all since we were lavishing praise on Bo Svensson's Mainz. This season, however, has started dreadfully for the side from Rhineland-Palatinate, who have picked up just 2 points from the opening 7 games of the campaign and sit second bottom in the table. The immediate post-international break fixture list will hardly provide the Mainz faithful with too much cause for optimism either, with a tasty Friday night trip to fellow strugglers Bochum sandwiched in between home games against Bayern Munich and RB Leipzig. So, Ali, where has it all gone wrong for Mainz so far this season?
Yeah, Michael, quite remarkably, it was almost 2 years ago to the day, in fact, that we covered Mainz's sustained revolution under Bo Svensson. And I suppose on that note, there probably is some value in briefly reminding ourselves of why the club were doing so well initially under Svensson, in order to understand why, laterally anyway, results have not been going their way. So, Michael, the early success under Svensson was mostly down to, a mightily impressive defensive record. So at this point in the 2021-2022 campaign, only Bayern Munich could boast a better expected goals against figure. What I would say is that even at that point, there were some concerns about where the goals would actually come from. There was nobody in the team who really stood out as somebody who could go on and get you 15, 20 odd goals a season. And the team as a whole wasn't really creating a huge amount of high quality chances. Now, of course, for what it's worth, they would ultimately address those issues in attack, and they would go on that season to become one of the most exciting teams to watch in the league under Svensson. Now, Jurgen Klopp, of course, managed Mainz from 2001 until 2008. And as the official Bundesliga website notes, the parallels between the way Svensson's Mainz were playing and Klopp's Gegenpressing were, they were really quite clear to see. And Svensson was able to achieve all of that without sacrificing too much of the early season defensive solidity. By the end of the 2021-2022 campaign, their expected goals against tally was still the fourth best in the league. Now, in any event, when you're as resolute defensively as Mainz once were under Svensson, it doesn't matter too much if you're not creating an awful lot in the final third, because, one goal would tend to be enough to get you some sort of result. But when that defensive stability starts to waver, naturally things can go south and results can start to dry up. This season, the Mainz defence has been porous, Michael, to say the least. They look quite simply a shadow of the side that was once so rugged and so hard to break down under Svensson. They've conceded a division-high 19 goals in their opening 17 league games, which works out at an average of 2.7 goals conceded per game. Now, if they were to keep going at this rate, they would have conceded 91 goals by the end of the season. And just for some context, Schalke, in that dreadful 2020-2021 campaign, even they only conceded, and I say only very loosely, they only conceded 86 goals. So it would be quite some doing to concede on 91 separate occasions. In attack as well, they've scored just 6 goals, so only Bochum in 16th place and Köln in 18th place have scored fewer. Interestingly enough, nobody in the squad has accumulated more than one expected goal across the opening 7 fixtures. And Mainz's non-penalty expected goals tally of 5.1 is also the lowest in the league by quite some distance. So it goes without saying, but when you're struggling to score goals and even create chances at one end of the park and you're hemorrhaging goals at the other end, the writing does tend to be on the wall. What I would say, however, is that Mainz have conceded 7.5 goals more than their expected goals against tally. And very few teams across Europe's top 5 leagues, if any, have underperformed more than Mainz in that respect. Ludovic Ajorc as well also became the first player in the history of the Bundesliga to fail to convert 2 penalties in one match, when he missed from the spot twice against Union Berlin back in August. They've also been without several key players due to injuries, including the likes of Andreas Hansch-Olsen in defence and the long-term absentee Jonathan Burkhardt in attack. Now, Burkhardt, of course, scored 11 goals in that memorable campaign a couple of years ago as a 21-year-old. And at the time, he looked like he would really kick on, but he did then have to undergo knee surgery last season and he still hasn't fully recovered. So you could maybe, Michael, try to make an argument that Mainz have perhaps been unlucky and that with a bit more fortune, they might not have found themselves occupying one of the 2 automatic relegation spots. I'm not sure how convincing an argument that would, however, be, but you could try to make that argument nonetheless. That said, there is at least one tangible reason for optimism at Mainz in the form of 19-year-old winger Brian Gruda, The Bundesliga website describes Gruda as the, quote, very definition of an attacking live wire with the explosiveness and sheer unpredictability to someday make him too hot to handle, unquote. So, yeah, Gruda, just for some background, he was the captain of the Mainz youth team that won the under-19s league title last season, scoring 17 goals in 34 games. In August, he picked up the silver Fritz Walter medal, the prestigious award presented annually to the best young German footballers. And yeah, to cement his status as a ray of hope, I suppose, for this Mainz team, he scored a beautiful goal in the 2-2 draw with Gladbach on match day 7 earlier this month. Do go and check out that goal from Brian Gruden. Do also go and check out Joe Scally's goal for Gladbach's two really impressive strikes in that one. Elsewhere, 18-year-old Nelson Viper is another one to watch, although he has missed the last few games with a knee injury. He actually picked up the gold Fritz Walter medal last year, and yeah, he was another standout in the club's league-winning under-19 side. If we look elsewhere, the summer signing of the 22-year-old defensive midfielder Tom Kraus from RB Leipzig for about €7 million all told looked like a really shrewd bit of business at the time. He hasn't quite hit the ground running at Mainz yet, but he was one of the best ball winners in the division last year with a really positive spell at Schalke on loan. No player in the division actually won more tackles than Kraus over the course of the season. So yeah, he's a really combative presence in the middle of the park, and if he can work his way into the starting 11, if he can rediscover his previous form, then yeah, the team as a whole will benefit massively. Just also as a further point, Viper, Gruda and Kraus have all been capped at youth level by Germany too. Let us not also forget, Michael, that Bo Svensson has in the past shown himself to be an excellent coach. Last September, his name was forming part of the conversation around who would succeed Graham Potter as the manager of Brighton. And at the end of last season, his points per game at Mainz actually bettered both Jurgen Klopp's points per game and Thomas Tuchel's points per game during their respective times in charge of the club. And yeah, I think what we really noticed with Svensson and Mainz was that he was really able to get the best out of the likes of Kari Monesiwo, Jonathan Burkhart, Leandro Barrero, Antoni Cacci and Dominic Kaur. So I think we do have to give credit to Svensson, and we do, I suppose, have to back him. On that note as well, the club, to their credit, has very publicly backed Svensson. Last month, the sporting director, Martin Schmidt, told Kicker, quote, "We have internal peace and are far from having a breakdown. We are 100% behind Bo, who's doing a great job," unquote. So clearly, Michael, the club aren't panicking just yet, but I do, however, worry for them, and the fixture list does look quite grisly, shall we say, over the next few weeks. So I think there's every chance, based on what we've seen from them so far this season, yeah, there's every chance that they pick up 0 points from their games against Bayern, Bochum and Leipzig. Let's see if, they can somehow get back on track. Okay, well, that was another hopefully enjoyable episode for you, the listener. I certainly enjoyed recording it. Loved hearing from Luke, loved hearing from Barlow, and of course, loved hearing from Michael. I'll let Michael go on to his game of fives now. I believe his pickup is waiting for him outside. And yeah, I'll wish Rudy Barlow a good evening as well. Also say thanks as always to you, the listener. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you're listening. Stay safe, stay well. See you in another 2 weeks. Goodbye.